Thank you. We are back in Joshua chapter 24 here this morning, looking at the next three verses as Joshua has just challenged the people of Israel, the nation of Israel, to make a choice, if you looked at last week, and these next three verses are their answer to that choice. I will give you a heads up, I guess now in 2 weeks we'll be looking at Joshua kind of pulling back on the reins and saying, whoa, not so fast, think through this, think through your answer first. But we want to look at their answer before Joshua reminds them of the significance of their answer. And I think there's great application to us today that we'd be able to answer the same way. Certainly in 2 weeks when we look at Joshua reminding them of what this means, I trust that we grasp that as well. But I think it would be great for us to be able to follow in their shoes and truly answer our choice this way. But before we dive into these three verses, let's begin with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you again for your word. I thank you for the example of the children of Israel, certainly proving they are just as human as we are, having great victories and great defeats in their spiritual walk. But I pray that as we look at what could be declared a spiritual victory in this moment, I pray that we'd be able to see the same choices in our lives, the same opportunity in our life to make the same commitment and same decision. And I just pray that, again, you'd allow me to decrease so that you alone will increase here this morning, that we'd be able to grasp your word, grasp the truths of your word, to be able to live them and make application to our lives today. I pray that you be with our time now as we continue on in your word. In Jesus' name, amen. The story is told from the writings, and I'm certain I'm not saying these Greek/Roman names correctly, but I'm assuming it is Gaius Plinius Secundus. He was known as, was it Pliny the Elder? Anyway, he wrote around the time of Christ, and around that time frame, the king demanded that a 99-foot obelisk be created. To help you visualize, I would guess that the Washington Monument has got to be pretty close to the same height, maybe a little higher. I don't know, I guess, how high the Washington Monument there in D.C. stands, but we're looking at something like that. It looks like a pencil sticking straight up into the air. So not large in diameter, although you can't usually use the word diameter when it's a, well, whatever that is, hexagon, square, whatever shape it is, however many sides it has. But anyway, it went 99 feet into the air, which is quite an accomplishment in that day and age. After years and literally years of design and work, it was time for this basically tower to be stood on end to show forth all of its elegance. And the engineer prepared, get this, 20,000 workers to pull on a pulley system of ropes that would lift up a hoisting apparatus to lift this thing into the air. 20,000 men. Now they just do it with a crane, and it's good and done. And one person works all the controls, and we have it done. But they had 20,000 workers to lift up something that they had been working on for years. Obviously, one small mistake, and years of work are destroyed. So as they began to lift this 99-foot masterpiece of sorts, the king ordered them to stop, and then he ordered that the son of the engineer be strapped to the apex of the obelisk, thus ensuring that both the heart and the mind of the engineer would be at play. What an absolute cruel task. But I would dare say that that engineer thought very carefully on every decision and very carefully watched as this thing slowly made its way up. I don't know how they got the kid off of this thing now that he's 99 feet in the air. I don't know how that all operated. But I can't imagine being put in that position. We don't live in those kinds of times of extreme commitment anymore. I think that's even changed to some extent in my generation. But even to a much greater extent, if you go back to one or even two generations before me, that kind of commitment, that kind of 100% wholehearted energy focused, heart and soul and mind just wrapped up into this kind of commitment, really isn't something that is evident anymore. Jobs are changed pretty easily and pretty quickly. Homes are sold and bought. Vehicles, same thing, sold and bought. Clothing. I'm glad sometimes that clothing is sold and rebought as styles change. Sometimes I think styles should be avoided and we should hold on to clothes, some clothes longer. Let's just skip this. And now that you go through stores and they're going back to the 70s of bell bottoms, I say hold on to this generation that we're wearing right now. Let's just skip back. Let's skip 70s 2.0 and move on from there. I'm hoping that the parachute pants and whatnot don't come next. And then we're really going to have some problems, I think. I was a part of a conversation this last week of they had a fundraiser for the Queens, not the OSA Queens, but the County Queens. And they had a pie, auction, a pie auction. And John Leeser always buys a pie every year, and then he brings it to work and sends out an email and says, hey, I got whatever kind of pie up in the upstairs refrigerator. Come and help yourself. And we had an auction, a land auction this week. So I was in the kitchen area where I could see through a window to see John sitting at his desk. And I do all the computer part of the auction while he's doing the blah, 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 that type of, that's all folks kind of a talk going on in the other room. And as we're sitting there during one of the breaks of the auction, John made some comment about the pies sitting there on the counter. And he said, that's a $700 pie. I thought, well, I probably... besides the fact that it's made with nuts, pecans, I believe, I don't think I could eat a $700 pie. That I wouldn't feel right eating a $700, even just a sliver. I couldn't eat a $700 pie. It helps that, if it was a $700 piece of beef, I could probably consider at least a sliver, but not into pies that much to eat a $700 slice of it. And then they began talking about how some pies went for a couple $1,000 for a pie. So they start rattling off, and these are all names that some of them I know very well, and I know the people, other ones I don't, but they're like, so-and-so made a pie, and it sold for $2,000. Somebody else made a pie, and it was like $1,500. And someone else, I don't know if there's a competition of whose pie gets the most. I think the one that went for $2,000, I think the Rumbles, which is a big name in this area, it was a Rumble that made it, and it was a Rumble that bought it, and they pretty much just said, we're buying this for $2,000, and that's what it sold for. But I began just in my mind thinking, all right, there's two, there's 1,500, there's 1,000, and then there were several in the 700, 800, 900. And so I'm adding these all up, and they got to the end, and I'm like, okay, just the pies you guys just said, they raised like $15,000. And they even said, and there were other pies there, we just don't remember how much they sold for. So I said, what does a beauty pageant need $15,000 plus for? Like, what are the expenses? It costs $100 to rent the facility they have it in. Like, so where does the rest of the money go? Well, apparently when you win a county fair, the winner gets to go to the state fair and the state pageant, I guess is what you'd say. And this auction pays for their transportation and lodging while they're in Springfield, but it also gives them the opportunity to pick a dress to wear to this said pageant. And I began hearing stories then of like they'd fly to, say, New York, get fitted for a dress, pick that dress up later, and then get transported to Springfield to wear that dress one time, and then it's done. And I thought to myself, I don't think a lot of weddings have the same kind of budget as this pageant for high schoolers and below. I'm sure I was sitting there at the table with my mouth like laying on the table thinking, what? I'm still trying to get over buying a pie for $2,000 and then you're talking, what? There's things that we could just go through, and I can't imagine spending that kind of money for a one-day event and then don't have use for that dress anymore. What do you do with it? And so we have come to an era, not just because of pageants, but we come to an era where kind of a throwaway generation era, where our commitment isn't as strong as it once was, and I would dare say not as strong as it was here in Joshua 24. But I'd also cautiously say, I think it's kind of migrated into our commitment to our God as well, unfortunately. We can stand strong for God today, but we'll see how things work tomorrow. We can be committed to God on a Sunday, but Monday, still to be determined, yet to be determined. The jury is still out. And so as we look at their answer to Joshua's choose you this day command, we want to look at what it truly means to cling to our God, to grasp tightly upon our God, to be wholeheartedly committed to our God. And a couple of important words as we begin in verse 16, and the people answered and said, this is Joshua 24, verse 16, people answered and said, God forbid that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. To reach the point where we have true commitment to our God, it truly is that we almost have our son tied to the top of a 99-foot, am I saying this correctly, obelisk, that is being raised up under our engineering. It's being raised up so to the point that if I make a mistake, it's going to cost my son's life. Do we have that kind of commitment to our God where it's an impossibility to do otherwise? We have a commitment where this is it. We are 100% in, and it's not even possible for us to consider anything less than 100%. Can you imagine as that engineer, not opening illustration, as that engineer saw his son being tied up, he's like, yeah, okay, whatever, you know, just do whatever you guys want to do. And he walks away. He goes home. I can't imagine the intensity that engineer had at that very moment, realizing that every move, every command, as he tells this 1,000 group over here to begin pulling on this rope, and this 1,000 group over here to begin loosening on their rope, I can't imagine the seriousness, the commitment he had as he began to quickly level out all the actions that are taking with 20,000 people. All the actions that are taking place in that moment to make sure not only that his job is accomplished correctly, but that his son's life is spared. That was a moment where it was an impossibility for him to do anything else but, in this case, succeed. There was no plan B for that engineer. There was not a, well, if this doesn't work out, maybe I'll work harder the next time. This was I am 100% in, and it has to work out. It has to work. They say, God forbid. It's an impossibility that we could do anything else but choose to serve our God. In Joshua chapter 22, verse 29, a similar statement is made. This, the timing is, remember, the 2.5 tribes have been sent back home after all the battles and after they've had the little congregational meeting there with Joshua. They've sent them back home, and it's debated on which side of the river they are on, but they build that altar. It was an altar of a memorial, not an altar of sacrifice. But the 9.5, what am I saying, right? Right, 9.5 tribes on the other side on the actual promised land are seeing this being erected and immediately go to Joshua and say, Something's not right here. We made it very clear that there's only one place to worship our God. There's only one place to sacrifice to your God. And these 2.5 tribes already have gone against our God by building that thing. And if you recall, there was a gathering, a meeting, and the elders go across the river and meet with them. And they just explain, hey, you cannot do this. Here's the reasoning why. You're bringing down judgment upon all of us because you've built this thing. You need to destroy it. This cannot be done. You can never do this. And their answer in Joshua 22:29, it says, God forbid that we should rebel against the Lord and turn this day from following the Lord and build an altar for burnt offerings, for meat offerings, or for sacrifice besides the altar of the Lord our God that is before his tabernacle. Their response was, This is not what you think it is. This is so that we might remember, and I think also so that you all might remember that the 2.5 tribes on this side of the river are under the same covenant that you are on the other side. And this monument that we are building is to remind us that we are chosen just like those on the other side. And it goes back to Phinehas, it goes back to Joshua. They determine, all right, that makes sense. Okay, we'll allow this to happen. But their answer in being charged with an accusation that seems to have gone contrary to their God, the answer of the leaders of these 2.5 tribes was, God forbid that we would ever do that. Same wording here is used in verse 16. It's an impossibility that we would do anything else but serve our God. Similar wording in the New Testament. Romans chapter 5, I know that you know this, but ends with the reality that our grace expounds, it grows. It is there, present, even greater than our sin. We sing songs about grace that is greater than our sin. And so chapter 5 concludes with that thought. And so chapter 6, Paul asks a question that has no necessary response. There's no name for that, but I'm forgetting it. A rhetorical question. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Hey, if grace is always going to be more sufficient than the necessity of our grace. In other words, as a sinner, our need for grace is huge. But the grace of God is always more than that. If that is the reality, and it is, Paul says, do we have license and liberty then to just sin and live however we want, knowing that God's grace is always going to be more abundant than the necessity for that grace? The amount of sin in our lives requiring grace in response, God will always have more grace than that amount. And his answer in verse 2 to his own question, what should we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? His very next two words are, God forbid. And then he begins to explain. This is not just that's not how we should do it. But it is literally hey, if you all have been buried with Christ and risen again to walk in newness of life, then it's an impossibility for you to live in a life that is just rampant with sin, with no realization of consequence, with no realization of your relationship with your God. It's an impossibility for a true believer to live such a life to push the parameters of God's grace. God forbid. It's an impossibility. Now, we are still sinners. We won't be sinless, even as Christians. But as a true child of God that has been buried and risen again with him, we don't have the means. It should not be a part of us to want to push the limits of God's grace. We understand the dying with him. We understand the rising with him. We understand the walking in newness of life because of him. And it's an impossibility to live how we want, to live caught in the bondage of sin anymore. So here they have their answer is the same as what Paul alludes to in Romans chapter 6. Here it's the same here in Joshua 24. Their response is, we can't do anything else. A commitment to our God has to begin with, we can't do anything else but serve our God. Here's one of our problems with today, and I think there were a lot of sermons. Maybe in the ebb and flows, the ups and downs of church history. So we start going in the wrong direction, and then there's a lot of preaching to correct that direction, and then maybe we emphasize that one thing too much, and then we go completely wrong, and so then they have to come back and preach on those, emphasize these things so that we kind of redirect our course again. But I think in that kind of ups and downs of Christianity, of church history, at some point, there was a lot of preaching on the necessity of throwing in the Lord willing, as if those two words keep us from any kind of commitments. You know what I mean? So a friend asks you if you can help them move on Saturday. Yeah, I should be able to do that, Lord willing. And we do it in a spiritual realm because obviously we don't know what a day may bring forth. We don't even know, or we don't have the guarantee that we'll even be alive I don't dare say that there's ever been a funeral where somebody stood up and said, "I object. They were going to help me move on Saturday, and they went and died on Thursday. How dare they?" I don't think there's ever been a funeral that has occurred. At least I would hope there has not been. But we throw in the words, "Lord willing," a lot of times to give us, for lack of a better way of saying it, an out, correct? It means of Saturday morning will come. I intend on being there at this point. But if I wake up and my back really hurts, I have an out. I guess it wasn't the Lord's will. If I wake up and there's something else has come up that's really important that I got to deal with, I said, "Lord willing." And I have an out for that. Not that we've actually spent the whole week praying to our God, "Lord, is it your will that I help them move or not?" But we've given ourselves an out. You apply for a job, and the new job suggests that with training involved, they would really like a multi-year commitment. And while we might not use the words, "Lord willing," because in a secular job environment, in our minds, we're thinking, "Well, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 5 years. I don't know my health. I don't know any of those details, and who can?" And so we make that kind of in our minds as well. I am willing to commit as much as I am able to commit at this point, but I don't know what's going to be, where my life will be in 5 years. I would imagine I'd still be working here, but I don't know. So there's always that backdoor opportunity. Example, the church needs a volunteer to mow the lawn for the summer. But it'd be for the whole summer. Lord willing, I'll be willing to help. And obviously we're going to say Lord willing because obviously if the lawnmower breaks, if we have an illness, if we've broken our leg, we got to have those opportunities where you can get out of the commitment that you've had. But, you know, I don't know that it would ever be, in most of those cases, it would ever be necessarily, quote, the Lord's will that we not do it. But it's easy to throw in those two simple words, Lord willing. As solely as it's kind of morphed in definition, solely as a backdoor escape, as a means that we can get out of our commitment if necessary, and almost as if we can blame it on the Lord for doing so. Well, I guess God didn't want me to do that, so I'm released from my verbal commitment that I've made. You know, there is no exception clause. There's no backdoor opportunity in this kind of commitment of this verse. When it said, "God forbid," there's no little parentheses that says, "Well, unless this or this happens." We have to understand that our commitment, while here on this earth, there may be a lot of things that we can't truly 100% commit to because, again, I don't know where we will be even this afternoon, much less tomorrow. We don't know what we're going to go through in this week. We don't know what kind of tragedy is going to hit our homes, our life, our families. We don't know what a day may bring. And we know that our life is but a vapor. And so that we know that our commitments are limited. I think John Leeser intends that I guess we're going to be missing most of next week, the following week, because we'll be gone. But he intends that by hiring me that I'm going to work 40 hours every week. And that's the intention on his part. That's the intention on my part. But neither of us can have the guarantee. But we have to be cautious when we look at our walk with our God to put the same exception clause in place, put the same back door in place. Lord, I will commit to you. Don't put the words, "Lord willing." Because it is always God's will that we commit to him. But I think in our mindset, we've gotten so used to the, we can't know, we don't know, we can't commit to the point of true commitment. But in all the other areas of life, we've got to be cautious that we don't do the same thing in our commitment to our God. We should be able to commit with such commitment that we can say, "I will serve the Lord my God. I don't know how long I will be here on this earth to do so." That is the variable. But our commitment should be, as long as I am here on this earth, I will serve the Lord. I don't know what tomorrow might bring, but I do know I'm committed to serve the Lord in it. I don't know what tragedy will fall upon our home in this next week, but I am committed to serving my God in it. I don't know what the job market will be like in a month. But I do know that even if I lose my job, I will serve the Lord. I don't know where our finances will be. But I do know I will commit to my God. I don't know where my health will be. But I do. Do you see what I'm trying to say here? Their commitment by those two words, God forbid, is a commitment that says, we don't know the variables at play. We don't know what is yet ahead of us. But we do know that we're going to commit to our God regardless. And that's clinging to our God. We've got all the other areas of life have the backdoor escape. Blame it on the Lord if we will. Lord willing, I'll be willing to help you. I don't know what's going to happen between now and Saturday when that time comes. And so know that my commitment may be tweaked a little bit. It might not work out, but I hope to. I intend to. But don't live that kind of walk with your God. Don't live that kind of unknown with our walk with our God. Don't have a backdoor escape with our commitment to our God. It's impossible. If we are truly going to cling to God, we've got to reach the point where it's an impossibility to do otherwise. That is a mental commitment. In our mind already, we have said, can't do anything else. This is what I have to do. This is what I must do. This is what I have chosen to do, and I am 100% committed to it. It is not an argument. There's nothing that can come in play in my life that will change that commitment. My commitment to help somebody move might change. My commitment to my job might change. My commitment to whatever might change. But we have to have a mental aptitude that says, a mental awareness, a mental commitment that says, I don't know those things, but this I do know. I will serve my God. Clinging to my God. It's impossible to do otherwise. Step two, we could say it that way, is we need to be very committed to not even loosening the grip. God forsake that we should, the word there, at least in the King James, is forsake the Lord to serve other gods. There seems to be a direct response to the message of the last chapter when Joshua seems to be addressing the leadership of the nation of Israel. And in Joshua 23, verse 8, it says, but cleave unto the Lord your God as ye have done unto this day. In other words, Joshua's telling them, continue doing what you have been doing recently. Keep that up. Don't let loose of that. That word cleave means to cling to. It's a full-hearted, full body, full mental, full body, soul, and mind attitude and action of clinging without releasing. When we looked at chapter 23, I said this. This requires a lot of courage. To be able to cleave unto the Lord your God as you have done unto this day, that takes tremendous courage. Because we don't know what tomorrow might bring. But it's a cleaving, a clinging. Their response here in this verse 16, people answered and said, God forbid. Those two very important words. That's the mental commitment that they've had. They've already determined in their mind, we will not change. We will not alter. We're going to be stubborn in this. We are going to be committed in this. But when it says that we should not forsake the Lord, they're saying, we will not do contrary to what you've told us already to do. You've told us to cling to our God wholeheartedly with all of our being. We will not, and that word forsaken has that idea of loosening our grip. We will not even loosen our grip on our God. We will not loosen our commitment and our clinging to our God to any extent. Now, consider for a moment, have you seen this in the secular realm over the last 10 years? I know in society as a whole, there's been a lot of loosening, has there not? Things that were once considered sinful are now considered a means of pride. Things that were once considered things you don't talk about are now openly discussed. Things that once were considered sacred are no longer considered sacred. All of society has been evidencing a loosening of a grip of morality, of a man-centered, although we could say it, of a righteousness, a man-centered righteousness at least, where it used to be you at least, even if you weren't a Christian, you at least tried to live right. That's not the case anymore. There's been a loosening. I just saw Canada is moving towards a new arena of assisted suicides, something that at this point is still not allowed in our nation. The story in Canada is being pushed because a transgendered individual who went through the surgeries to change their genders is now regretting that action and has no reason to live, and he can't deal with the pain, the literal physical and, I'm guessing, mental and emotional pain that's involved. And he believes that, and I think it was a guy that wanted to become a female, so I hope I'm using the right, they wouldn't say it was the right one, but the right pronoun here. But he believes that the best option at this point was be for the nation, for the state, to allow him to end his life. And so that is being discussed in Canada. I can guarantee you it will not be long here until it's here, because that's how it's always been. Canada starts, we follow. Stepping on that interesting topic, because it will become a great topic of discussion, public discussion here soon, I believe. You know that there is no surgery that will ever change a person's gender. You can't change a gender by surgery. You can mutilate the external physical aspects of our bodies. Well, that doesn't change your gender. Gender was determined at our conception. And it was called out by our doctor at our birth. Oh, it's a boy, girl. It's not a fluid thing. It's not something that we can change because we've decided we want to change. It's not something we can change because we've gone through a surgery. We can change the way we look. I can grow long hair. I can have short hair. I can change the way I look. But it doesn't change my DNA. And so the bizarre avenues that we are on that are leading to, and that shouldn't surprise us, when the direction of forsaking all that God has leaves us with only one option, death. It shouldn't surprise us of where they are right now in Canada. But that will be a discussion that I can guarantee will soon be happening here in our states. Hollywood depicts this moment. Well, they depict that perverse moment as well, but Hollywood depicts this moment of that loosening in a very inhumane way. I'm somewhat being comical here, but the reality is, have you ever seen, I guess it would have to be an action movie of some sort. Ever seen an action movie where it has come down to one person holding on to another person to save them from imminent death? And it almost seems like this is how Hollywood does it. First, you have forearm to forearm. They're like, you know, maybe they're holding, hanging over a cliff, and they've caught them. And they're hanging forearm to forearm. And then what begins to happen? The camera zooms in on the intensity of the eyes on both individuals. And usually the person dangling from the thread, so to speak, is saying, don't you let go. Don't you let go. What always happens in a Hollywood movie? They begin to, you know, there's sweat dripping off of the noses of the guy on the top, and then they're down to the hands, and they've got their hands, it's hard to do when you've got your own hands, but they got their hands now interlocked. No longer is it forearm to forearm, now it's just hand. But what begins to happen then? Before long, it's down to fingertips, four fingertips. Then what happened? And this is all like in the course of like 10 minutes. Like, how does this even happen in human, in reality? This is not how this works. But then they come down to, and then what begins to happen? It's down to, whoa, one finger, whoa, and now we're down. Now we're down to, we're like hanging on to each other. There's no human being possible that can hold an entire body up with one finger. If your biceps and your forearms can't do it, this finger cannot. It's an impossibility. But in the movies, it gets your heart going, it gets your energy going up, and you're rooting for the underdog, and don't let go, don't let go, don't let go. Now, depending on what kind of movie you're watching, if you're watching a kid's movie, here's what happens. A hero shows up, throws a lasso down, and pulls the person up, right as the last finger slip. Whew. If it's more of a PG-13 or above kind of a movie, you know that last finger is going to slip in. No! It's the slow, but it's even slower than the 10 minutes of slipping and down to the last finger. It's the gravity goes like in half, and it's a slow process of falling to an imminent death below, while screaming, "No!" Well, that's a great depiction of what it does of loosening the grip. They're describing exactly what they said they will not do. In physical reality, that's really impossible. That's not how things work. If your biceps can't do it, your grip strength probably won't. And if your grip strength won't do it, your fingertips aren't going to be able to do it. Now, if your fingertips are able to do it, then your biceps certainly could, but not the other way around. So in that way, Hollywood's got it all wrong, but it helps for movies. It helps for adrenaline. It helps for excitement. It helps for the routine of the underdog. But it does depict exactly what happens when we begin to loosen a grip. And it depicts exactly what the children of Israel are saying when they use the word forsake. They are saying, we will not loosen our grip on our God. We won't even loosen our grip. Can you imagine having that kind of a commitment? To be able to say, God forbid, it's an impossibility. There's the mental commitment. But here, I'm calling it the spiritual commitment because we're not actually dealing with bicep strength or finger strength holding somebody off the edge of a cliff. We're talking about the spiritual strength to be able to say, I am committing to the reality that I will not loosen my grip. I will not forsake the Lord to serve another God. I will not loosen my grip on my God. There are a lot of things. There are a lot of pry bars that come into our life and our spiritual walk. They are prying really hard to get us to loosen that grip. There's a lot of times that we have the need for tremendous zeal to continue staying steadfast in our God. There will be a lot of temptations in our life that will begin to say, you know what, you don't need to be that strongly committed. Take a step back and take a breath. Don't be so zealous for your God. There's going to be a lot of things that are going to say, you don't have to do that. But here's what happens when you decide, I can loosen up. We go from this to this to this to this. And this never works. And then we find ourselves falling, spiritually falling, and we're wondering, how did this happen? We loosened our grip. We lacked the spiritual commitment to say, I'm going to hold on, and I'm not going to loosen. Forsaking our God, as it says there, we will not forsake, is an easy picture of that, is like, all right, we're going to serve our God. No, we're not. We're going to walk away this way. But the literal word of forsaking our God is, I'm just going to let up a little bit. Just a little. You know, in the day and age that we live in today, we can't let up a little. We can't loosen our grip. There has to be a mental commitment. It's an impossibility to do otherwise. God forbid. There has to be a spiritual strength involved, a spiritual commitment involved. We will not loosen our grip. You know that every one of us, from the oldest to the youngest, if we're a child of God, has the spiritual ability, because we have Christ within us, we have the spiritual ability to make that kind of commitment that I will not forsake my God. This does not require us to have Arnold Schwarzenegger biceps. This does not require us to be doing figure exercises so that we will never let go when we're down to this. There's no physical aptitude test for this. It is solely a spiritual commitment that we make. I am not going to let loose of my God, even to the smallest extent. I am going to hold tight. When our kids were much younger, and we go for a day trip to Chicago, which we have done quite frequently, maybe not every year, but frequent enough. When they were much younger, boy, I can tell you this, I grabbed the hold of a hand, and I don't care if what happened. I don't care if, you know, there could have been a car accident happening right in front of me, and I would know I should go help. I'm not letting loose of that hand until I know that that little hand inside my hand is now in her hand. And there's that commitment to know that there's so many people around here. If I even let loose of that hand might slip out and I might not even notice it until it's too late. I've got to hold tightly. And as a father, that's not hard to do. I'm committed as a dad. I'm going to hold on to that little hand because I know if I let loose, I might lose them. They'll get lost in a crowd, and who knows what happens from thereafter. I'm going to hold on to that little hand. Well, will we make that same kind of spiritual commitment that we're going to hold on, and it's not a little hand to hold on to. We're going to hold on to the almighty hand of God and not loosen our grip. But lastly, very quickly, verses 17 and 18 says, "For the Lord," here's our reasoning, "For the Lord our God, he it is that brought us up our fathers out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, and which did those great signs in our sight, and preserved us in all the ways wherein we went, and among all the people through whom we passed. And the Lord drave out from out before us all the people, even the Amorites, which dwelt in the land. Therefore," and I know that's italicized, so it was added, but the purpose, the meaning there is, "therefore we will also serve the Lord, for he is our God." Do not loosen the grip, but also thirdly, do not forget. God rescued us. God preserved us. God delivered us. Therefore, how can we serve anybody else? Why would we serve anybody else? And the last statement there, "for he is our God." There's a verbal commitment. He is our God. Why would we serve anybody else when he is our God? If he is our God, then he's the one that we're going to serve. There is no other God but him, so there is no other reason to serve anybody else but him. Another one of my fears as far as the ups and downs of church in general. I think in the 60s through probably the 80s for the most part, the church in general made great strides in outreach. Sunday school became, I know D.L. Moody was kind of credited with kind of getting the Sunday school moment started, but certainly the 60s and 70s into the 80s was a huge Sunday school movement in church history. Vacation Bible schools became the norm for churches during the summer. The bus ministries became the norm for churches. In fact, if you were going to be, quote, a growing church, you had to have a fleet of buses in your parking lot. And it became a sign of a good, godly church to have a bus or buses. And so we had this great emphasis of outreach, of gathering and committed to the next generation. An evangelism explosion, kind of in quotes, but kind of not, because that literally was a movement. The evangelism explosion era of the church resulted in a lot of raised hands, a lot of repeated prayers, a ton of baptisms, and a lot of people making professions of faith based on a stated prayer, but lacking the understanding of who their God really was. I have talked to a lot of people over the last decade or two that are living a complete life, basically a life of the end of Romans chapter 5. Hey, grace is big enough for my sin. I'm going to live however I want. They are living to their own desires, their own abilities, and I begin to have a conversation with them, and their words will be something like this. "I went to church once, and I raised my hand, and I said a prayer." And then their next words are going to be something along these lines. "But I don't know what that did." I can't tell you how many times directly that word, those words have been said to me. And I know that in the vast number of people from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that raised their hand and said a prayer, there are a vast number that truly were saved. But I think there's perhaps a greater number of those that did what their friends did. They wanted the gain, they wanted the benefit, but they didn't understand who their God was. They didn't understand why they were doing that. They didn't really grasp the reality of what that prayer, I could say it this way, literally, biblically, didn't do for them. The prayer did nothing for them. It was that Christ did everything for them. But now they're living a life and they don't feel God at all. They don't know what that action in the past has anything to do with their life of today. And while it was a great movement of the church as far as numbers go, I fear that now we have a generation of growing adults who look back and say, "I once attended Sunday school, and I remember in this classroom with Mrs. So-and-so, I raised my hand and I said a prayer, but I don't know what that means. I don't feel God in my life. I don't sense him. I haven't even thought about God. I haven't thought about Sunday school for decades until the very moment that I'm talking to you and I happen to know that you're a pastor. I don't know who my God is." Do we have the verbal commitment that says, I know who my God is? Can I sit down and share with you who my God is? Can I tell you what he did here, what he did here, and what he did here and here and here and here and here and here? It's literally what these last verses were, verse 17 and 18. They're literally saying, they conclude with, I know who my God is. But they've proven that point already. Their concluding statement is, I know who God is. I know who our God is. But they've already proven that statement before they've even said it, because they've said, God did this, and God did this, and God did this, and God did this, and he did this as well. I know who God is. It's not because I raised my hand and said a prayer back in Sunday school when I was 12 years old, and I haven't been to church since. I don't know anything about the Bible. I don't know anything about life in my spiritual walk. I don't know who God is. But my mind goes back to everything must be okay, because I remember back in that day I said a prayer in Mrs. So-and-so's classroom. But the reality of their God today is absent. Do we have the verbal commitment today that says, I know who God is. I know who he is. And here's who he is. He is. And I think I mentioned recently, we need to get back to having those at least quarterly, those I'm thankful that God is, because I think that's a great reminder for us, but a great encouragement to those that we were sending those cards. See, we kind of stopped in COVID. We should maybe get that started again, because it forces us to remind ourselves, who is God to us? What right now do we grasp about our God? Because we know who our God is, and here's what he's done. He has delivered us. He's rescued us. He's preserved us. He's doing this for us. He has, and he has, and he has, and he has, and we have the confidence that what he has been doing, he will continue to do. I know who my God is. Not a lot of people can say that today. And that's a sad reality. What is also great, and we're going to look at this verse here maybe in a few weeks, but jump to verse 31, one of the last verses of this chapter. Verse 31, as far as the time frame goes, is after Joshua has died. And verse 31 says this, and Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. Their commitment lasted. Now, heads up, when we get to this passage, I will probably point out, they neglected their children and their grandchildren, but their commitment was true. Those three points that we did just now this morning, they truly did. We know history, the children of Israel, boy, they had judges. They had the consequences, they had captivities, and then they're released, and then they get recaptured, and then they're released. They had ups and downs where they served God, and then they rejected God, and they served God, and they rejected God. They had that going on, but their commitment that they made in these verses we just read here this morning, for the rest of Joshua's life and for the next generation after Joshua, they did what they committed to. It wasn't a, this is what we should do, this is the textbook answer, so we're just going to give it. It truly was their heart. Is it ours? Do we have that kind of commitment? Let's pray. Dear Lord, we thank you again for your word. We thank you for the example of the children of Israel, for this generation in particular, for the offspring of a generation that doubted you and would be the parents of a generation that turned from you. But in this very moment, in this generation here of Joshua chapter 24, they made a commitment to you and they did it. They served you. They were faithful to you. And I pray that we would be that generation as well, that we would make such a strong commitment that our fingers wouldn't begin to slip, begin to loosen, that we wouldn't begin to wander, that we wouldn't begin to make excuses, that while there's so many other variables in life that we cannot control, that we are committed to our service to you, our faithfulness to you. I pray that we would truly learn to cling to you, come what may, that it would not change. And we give you the praise as we live this out now here in our lives beginning today. In Jesus' name, amen. Want to stand as we sing hymn number 562, Just As I Am, just the first verse.